Law School of Epsilon City in Chicago. And you've been here Notre Dame before, and have very much enjoyed the experience, and I look forward to having another day here on campus. Before we get into the cases today, we have a motion for admission to the bar, and I have the honor of making the motion before my colleagues. So Judge Mannion and Judge Feeney, I respectfully move the admission to the bar of two of my law clerks, and I appreciate if they would come forward to the podium, please. Your Honor, the first candidate is Ms. Michelle Peterson of Davenport, Iowa. Ms. Peterson holds a Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Notre Dame, where she majored in Government and International Studies, as well as Sociology. She's then got her law degree at the Harvard University, graduating in June of 2005. Her co-clerk is Mr. Dwayne Loft. Mr. Dwayne Loft is from New York, New York. Mr. Loft received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Fordham University in 2002 in the area of comparative literature. And he then received his law degree from Fordham University in June of 2005. I can assure you that both of these individuals have served the court with distinction and are very worthy candidates for admission to the bar of the court.
Certainly go along with the admission of the
bar. You will go over to the clerk's desk and he will administer the oath.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will demean yourself as an attorney and counsel of this court uprightly and according to the law, and then you will support the Constitution of the United States?
I do.
Congratulations.
Our first case this morning is number 053912, Robert Brown against the City of Michigan City. Mr. Falk.
May it please the court. For more than 25 years, Robert Brown has gone to Washington Park in Michigan City virtually every day. While there, he stays in his vehicle, he looks at the lake and people on the beach, he smokes, he listens to the radio and drinks coffee. Since he has never done anything that violated any park rules, he was ignored by Michigan City authorities until 2002, when it was discovered that in 1995 he had pled guilty to one count of child molestation, serving a short prison sentence. After observing Mr. Brown's daily routine throughout the month of July, Michigan City banned him for life from all his parks and explicitly labeled him in Resolution 552 as someone whose observed behavior in Washington Park constitutes a threat to children. Mr. Brown never received any notice concerning the meeting on August 29th, which led to Resolution 552, because no notice was given. He never received any sort of notice informing him of the grounds for the proposed ban and informing him that...
What was the notice that was provided?
Well, there was no notice provided for the August 29th meeting, Your Honor. On July 31st, there was notice provided for a meeting for the earlier resolution, and what that notice was a statement saying that the subject of banning him would be taken up by the Michigan City Park and Recreation Board. However, again, that notice is not relevant because the ban... His personal ban, banning him for being someone who is a sexual predator who is engaging in dangerous behavior in the park, that occurred at Resolution 552 on August 29th.
That's the one where they scaled it back from the general prohibition to just him.
That's correct. That is also the one where they articulated in the body of the resolution that he was engaged in observed behavior that was dangerous to children. As we noted in our brief, Your Honor, there was no requirement on the procedural due process that any notice be given concerning the resolution on August 1st, because that resolution banned all sex offenders, regardless of whether they had ever set foot in Michigan City, let alone the park. Under the rule of Connecticut Department of Public Safety versus DOE, there is no need to give due process when there is nothing relevant that can be accomplished through the giving of the procedure.
Can this be labeled as continuance of that first hearing in any way?
No, Your Honor. The first hearing, again, was a resolution that banned all offenders, regardless of whether they had ever set foot in Michigan City. The second meeting was specific to Mr. Brown. I should also note, however, Your Honor, that the notice that was given on July 31st did not satisfy due process. All it said, again, very tersely, was that the matter of banning you is going to be considered by the Parks Department. There was no indication of the reason And there was no reason for Mr. Brown to know that what the reasons were. He'd been engaging in the same behavior for more than a quarter century. And there was no indication that he had any right to appear at any sort of hearing. And in fact, the meeting on August 1st was not an adjudicatory hearing. It was merely a legislative meeting to approve the resolution that banned all sex offenders. There was no relevance to anything Mr. Brown could say because the ban did not concern him. The ban did not concern any activities in the park. The ban was just a general ban of all sex offenders in the universe. It wasn't until we got to Resolution 552.
Well, you did discuss his case at some length, though, that first meeting. It may, in fact, there's one paragraph in the resolution that emanated from that meeting that deals specifically with him.
He was discussed, Your Honor, but the resolution and what was being considered was a ban of all sex offenders. And whether he was dangerous or not dangerous, whether he'd ever been in the park or not been in the park, simply was not relevant.
If he had attended that meeting, would he not have had an opportunity to give his side of the story?
Well, I do not know that, Your Honor, but even if he had given his side of the story, it would have been irrelevant to the statutory scheme. Again, we're back to Connecticut Department of Public Safety versus Doe. Michigan City had determined to ban all sex offenders. Whether Mr. Brown had even stepped foot in the park wasn't relevant to that statutory scheme, and given that due process was not required, he certainly did not waive anything by not appearing. And again, the notice itself was sufficient. You have to be told of the reasons. How was he to prepare for, even if the decision was going to be based on his precise behavior, how was he to be preparing for that when he is told nothing? And therefore, there was the notice on July 31st is simply irrelevant. He got no notice prior to August 29th.
Or if it is relevant, infirm. Is that your point?
I'm sorry?
Or if it is relevant, it is infirm.
That's correct. First argument is that it's legally irrelevant because it's not relevant to the actual ban, but the actual notice itself did not satisfy due process.
The fact that it's a different ordinance, not 548 amended to 552,
yes,
does that have any difference as far as a separate hearing?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the distinction is not the naming of the ordinance, but that 548 was, we are banning everyone. We really don't care what your personal story is. We don't care if you've ever set foot in Michigan City before, you're banned. 552 was, okay, Mr. Brown, we're talking about you. And we're not saying, by the way, we're not just saying you're a sex offender. We're saying that you have engaged in observed behavior. We have seen you in Michigan City Park, and we have seen you commit actions which are a threat to children. Obviously, that is completely different. That raises both liberty and property interests, and he had to be accorded due process for that meeting, and he was not. So what we are left with is a resolution banning him personally, of which he was not given notice. We're faced with a resolution banning him personally that is not based on any ascertainable standards at all. We have the need for ascertainable standards, of course, so that we do not have arbitrary decision making. We have Mr. Brown, who engaged innocent behavior for a quarter of a century, being banned. We have someone who actually committed a sex offense, or alleged to have committed a sex offense in the park, being banned for a year and a half. Obviously, the need for ascertainable standards is clear. And finally, we have someone being banned for life from the parks in Michigan City without ever being afforded an adjudicatory hearing.
Now, did that hearing be based on the fact that he had some sort of property right?
He has both a property right and a liberty interest, Your Honor. The property right extends from the fact that Michigan City has held out to the world that everyone in the world can come to Michigan City Park, with the exception now of Mr. Brown. That understanding is certainly sufficient to create a property interest. There's also a liberty interest.
To everyone in the world, people outside the city have to stay, don't they?
That's correct.
And he's inside the city, so he gets a free pass.
He had a free pass, and in a symbolic stripping of his property interest, before this first hearing, the police came to Mr. Brown's park, stripped the pass from him, and told him that if he showed up in the park again, he would be arrested for criminal trespass. And obviously, the fact that if Mr. Brown steps into the park today, he will be arrested for criminal trespass, is an altering of his status, which is the plus factor for stigma plus for purposes of a liberty interest. And of course, he has now been labeled not just as a sex offender, but as I said, as someone who is cruising the park, engaging in dangerous conduct of children, that certainly is a stigma, and the stigma.
The majority of the space in your brief on liberty interest is devoted to this stigma plus concept.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that the only theory upon which you're arguing liberty interest?
Yes, Your Honor. This court held in Doe versus City of Lafayette that there is no substantive due process right, fundamental right, to enter the park. Therefore, we're not claiming that this denies him some sort of fundamental constitutional right, but however, it is denying him a
liberty interest that does not involve a fundamental right, still be a liberty interest?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, you can have a liberty interest if your physical liberty is taken away from you. But when you're dealing with something that is harming reputation under the rule of Paul B. Davis, what we're dealing with is stigma and plus.
But is reputation the only infringement on his liberty interest that he is experiencing?
Well, I guess abstractly, Your Honor, he's now prohibited from walking into the park, and he will be arrested if he walks into the park. And that, to that extent, there is a deprivation of liberty, but I don't think we need to go there because there's such a clear fitting here with the rules of Paul B. Davis in Wisconsin versus Constantine.
What about the property? And we're focused on that. Is it the fact that they took his past away?
No, Your Honor.
What is
it? It is the fact that there is an understanding, and we know from Perry versus Sinderman that property interests can be created by understanding. There's an understanding between Michigan City and the populace that you have the right to come to the park. And there's a further understanding with its own citizens that you have the right to come to the park for free. As I said, the stripping of the piece of paper off of his dashboard is symbolic of his loss of property, but the property interest itself is his right to enter the park. And that right has been taken away from him without any procedural due process.
Does that apply to anybody in any park in the state of Indiana? The right to enter the park?
Well, it depends what the understanding is. I think in most situations it probably would, but the only evidence we have is
what was the understanding in Lafayette?
That was a similar understanding, but in the city of Lafayette, there was not raised a procedural due process claim. The city of Lafayette case was based solely on a substance due process claim. And in fact, the court in that case, both the majority and the dissent, commented on the fact that there was a property inside a procedural due process claim had not been raised. Here, of course, we have a procedural due process because we have Mr. Brown, who has done nothing wrong, who has evidence to demonstrate that. He can demonstrate from people that he's been doing this for 25 years. He can demonstrate that this is his pattern of behavior. He can demonstrate that this is innocent behavior. He was denied that right. He was denied this.
I'm somewhat confused. Was there some indication that he actually did leave his vehicle when he...
He indicated that he left on only a few occasions. He had gone... A couple times he hadn't gone to this area, he'd gone to another area where there's a boat dock and he'd gone fishing. On one occasion he had gone to some sort of show in the park. In none of those occasions did he go to the area in Washington Park by the beach and then get out of the beach and leave. I think those were areas he went to other places in the park. A couple occasions he went with his grandchildren to the park, I'm taking it some years ago. But his routine, which he's done every day since his wife was still alive and continued after her death, is stay in the vehicle, look at the park, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, listen to the radio. And he was not given any opportunity to demonstrate this. And therefore, the trial court erred in denying his motion for summary judgment and granting the city's motion for summary judgment.
Would you be looking at a hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that would be the procedural due process hearing.
What we're looking for is a reversal. Then, of course, it's up to Michigan City at this point to determine whether they wish to continue with this, given that they now know that his behavior is innocent behavior. If they choose to, then he is entitled to a hearing pursuant to notice with ascertainable standards at some point before some neutral decision maker, which is basic due process. We're not asking for a trial. We're asking merely for what he should have had back in 2002, the opportunity to demonstrate what he was doing with innocent. And he was denied that right, and therefore he was denied procedural due process. To the extent that Michigan City is attempting to ban Mr. Brown for his innocent behavior over 25 years, and that is all they intend to show, we would argue also that violates substantive due process. Conceding, of course, there is no fundamental constitutional right to enter the park, nevertheless, the ban has to be rational. And if indeed Mr. Brown is engaging only in innocent behavior, it's irrational to ban him. This is unlike Doe, where this court found that Mr. Doe had entered the park from Lafayette and acted in a dangerous way. Here, Mr. Brown is continuing only innocent conduct, and therefore it would violate substance due process as well to ban him. Trial court therefore erred in granting summary judgment to Michigan City. The trial court decision must be reversed and partial summary judgment entered for Mr. Brown. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
May please the court. The position of Michigan City in this case is the action that it took in banning indefinitely Mr. Brown from his city park did not violate any interest he had protected by the 14th Amendment under due process. And in addition, that he was provided due process before the indefinite ban was entered, and so his rights would not have been violated even if he was entitled to due process in this case. Contrary to the argument made by the appellant, we have a situation not only where the appellant is a convicted child molester, we also have evidence observed over a period of time, first as a result of a warning call received from an adjacent township of suspicious behavior by Mr. Brown in another park, but then of course over a period of about 30 days where he was observed by various park personnel engaging in a pattern of suspicious activity in light of the fact that he's a known convicted child molester. He was coming to this park, which is adjacent to Lake Michigan by a beach, which contains a zoo and a large daycare center. He was seen in a RV van, a conversion van, that has drapes, has a back door to it, and has areas that can be hidden from public view. He would pull up to the beach and park there for hours at a time on hot, warm, sunny days, in the car, never getting out, seen by various park personnel with binoculars surveying the beach. He would drive back and forth slowly past the daycare center. This caused considerable concern for lifeguards, daycare workers, and other park employees. This led then to the decision of the park board to indefinitely ban Mr. Brown from his park.
Would it make any difference if they'd known that he'd been doing this for 24 years, or that with his wife, and this was his routine? Where does it make sense?
Certainly, Mr. Brown could have presented that information to the board to consider. Whether it would have had any effect on its decision, of course, is hard to predict. However, the specific behavior that was seen that was judged to be suspicious is not in controversy here. He and Mr. Brown admits what was characterized as suspicious behavior. He claims that he was doing this before and no one noticed. Of course, that's only his word that he did so. All the information that Mr. Brown claims he would have presented to the board had he shown for the hearing that he was given notice of would have been within his own power to present. He could have told the board about his activities. He could have told the board that he was acting innocently. That would have been freedom of the board to judge his demeanor, to judge his credibility, and to make a determination whether they thought it appropriate to enter some sort of ban or not.
Would you want to present evidence from professional individuals who have examined this case and perhaps to testify that this wasn't a danger?
Certainly he could have done so, but he's not suggested anywhere on the record that he would have or wanted to, or that there was any expert evidence available for him to present.
How many notice did he have in order to put together that kind of presentation?
Well, he was given 24 hours of written notice that the hearing would be held. It was personally delivered to him 24 hours before the hearing was scheduled. He then had a person on his behalf contact the park superintendent and ask about that and was specifically told that he could attend. He did not make any request that the hearing be continued or did he be given more time to prepare for it.
So they wouldn't give him a written statement that they wouldn't arrest him. He was going to be arrested on site, and that was the order. And they said, well, if you can show up, they probably won't arrest you. No, we're not going to give you a written guarantee that you won't be.
The park board, which issued the notice to Mr. Brown, did not issue any kind of order for him to be arrested. Yes, he was told by a police officer when his pass was removed from him 2 days earlier that if he returned to the park, he would be arrested. But it was made clear through the oral conversations that he was invited and able to come to the park board meeting, which just coincidentally happened to be in a building that was within this large Washington park. So to suggest that they were luring him in there just to arrest him, I think is a stretch, based on the fact of this case. And for him to conclude that was the purpose of inviting him to come to a meeting just so he could be arrested, I don't think that's a reasonable conclusion for him to make under those circumstances, given that there was oral communication with the superintendent of the park.
It may not seem a particularly probable scenario for you or for me, but for a person who served time, that might be a very reasonable conclusion.
Not when they had oral communication with the park superintendent, the person who's in charge of the park, and having direct communication indicating that he's welcome to attend this meeting. And they gave him written notice for that purpose.
That he could attend. What happened to the ordinance that was, or the, I guess it's an ordinance, passed on the August 1st meeting? Was it repealed?
basically it was substituted for by the later ordinance. And to understand the scenario of how and why that occurred, it's important to recognize that the initial ordinance isn't, as Mr. Falk suggested, an ordinance that simply banned all convicted child molesters from the park. It's a twofold ordinance. One that said Mr. Brown specifically was banned indefinitely from the park. Secondly, the other unknown convicted child molesters were banned as well. Mr. Brown was then given notice of this ordinance, this resolution that had been passed. He then went and filed a class action lawsuit in federal court within 2 weeks of that time, seeking to have that resolution overturned as unconstitutional. It was after that lawsuit was received that the park board then met later in the month to consider how to respond to that lawsuit and determined to pass this new resolution that simply removed the language about all convicted child molesters and left the language with respect to Mrs. Brown.
So the language is unchanged from the first resolution to the second one?
There is a slight change in one of the whereas paragraphs about the conclusion of the park board that based upon Mr. Brown's prior status as a convicted child molester and his observed activity in the park, that they deemed it or drew a conclusion that this presented a danger to children. But the actual resolution about indefinitely banning Mr. Brown from the park was unchanged. So this isn't so much a new or different resolution with respect to Mr. Brown. It only changed the status of the unknown convicted child molesters who were originally included in the first resolution.
Well, I don't know the procedure. You should say there's legislative procedures. Obviously, if you have a law that you pass and you have first reading, second reading, if you're going to amend it, you will do that at the second reading and then you have the final set. Here, it looks like this is a displacement or replacement. Now, if it's a resolution, is that different than an ordinance? I'm not sure what status is the law.
In effect, it's a resolution rather than a law. If the park board has limited authority to act, it's different than a city council or something like that. It's passing a resolution, in effect, indicating its decision on how it's going to operate and manage the park. The park board would have the ability to go to the police and have the resolution enforced in this particular case.
It has the force of law.
Yes, it does have the force of law with respect to the park because under Indiana statute, the park board has the authority to operate and maintain the park. And so it was in its authority to determine rules and regulations for the operation and maintenance of the park. And so it doesn't have to go through that reading process that would happen with legislation before a state government, for instance. And it's important here to understand that the original resolution was not passed as a mere legislative act. It's clear from the record here that the time that the initial hearing was held, that Mr. Brown was invited to attend, that they went through a great deal of evidence that was presented to this park board about his suspicious activities in the park. And that there were many questions asked by the park board members about his activities and what the evidence was and what it demonstrated and about the legality of what they were permitted to do under these circumstances.
Well, you know, I can look at this in the abstract as well, and you've got a child molester, you've got suspicious activity, you've got a guy in there with curtains in his van, all sorts of really fishy stuff. So it's understandable what the parks do, but nobody came up and said, well, I've been doing that for a long time, and that, that's the way my van's set up, it's old, it's decrepit. This guy is a special ed, he's living with his daughter, he's not on the front row. And so the question is, did he have any opportunity to at least express himself? And frankly, the result may well have been the same. But it's just a question of whether he got to put his side. I know it's in your own brief, page 14, where you go through this, what Brown might have done in parts, and then go through sort of if we'd known this and that, then maybe, that'd have been fine if we had that information. But it doesn't say that the result would be the same. It just means there's a lot of stuff he didn't know.
Well, and in fact, it's unfair to suggest that the park board could, in the abstract, determine whether they would have made the same decision without this knowledge. What's important is Mr. Brown had that information. He wouldn't have required any time to get ready to present because it was all within his own personal knowledge. He was invited to attend the hearing, had the opportunity to do so, could have presented that evidence again. The park board could have made a judgment based upon what he had to say, whether that made any difference to them about their final decision or not.
Well, what it could have possibly made a difference, as Drupal pointed out, to bring in experts, to somebody that's done it, maybe a treating physician or somebody that said this was an aberrant thing, he was on drugs and, you know, drunk, you know, that's sort of an excuse. But it happened one time, some time ago. But he had this routine of going out there for 20 plus years.
A due process requires only that the person be given the opportunity to do that. It's not the obligation of the government to go out and seek this information separately or affirmatively when they have no reason to do so.
So you're relying on that first notice and the fact that he didn't show up.
That's correct. And also, we have an argument that was found to be prevailing in the district court that Mr. Brown doesn't have a protected property interest and doesn't have a protected liberty interest, so he wasn't entitled to notice even though we gave it to him. He wasn't entitled to an opportunity to be heard though we gave it to him, and he wasn't entitled to a hearing though one was held. So, on top of this issue about providing him with reasonable notice, and the notice only needs to be reasonable notice, it doesn't have to be perfect notice. The procedures don't have to be perfect under these circumstances. They just have to be reasonable to satisfy the 14th Amendment. With respect to the property interest, there have been no case law and no statute cited in the brief of the appellant indicating any property interest in entering a park. And it's hard to believe or conceive how someone entering a place like a park could create a property interest. Certainly it doesn't sound like property. It's not something you can sell. It isn't something that has pecuniary value. And the Supreme Court has indicated on multiple occasions its desire not to expand the definition of property under the 14th Amendment. There's been no cases presented like this to suggest that a property interest could be found. I did, however, find a case, and I'm sorry it's not in my brief, that dealt with whether or not the right to enter a public building created a property interest. And this was a case where a person who worked in this public building was accused of sexual harassment.
Have you informed counsel the opposition to this case?
I have not, because I just filed it, Your Honor.
Well, rather than tell counsel about it today, you've made within 10 days a letter to the court that advises the case and how we can talk to your case, and I'm going to give counsel for the appellant's 10 days answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very much. But in any event, it's the obligation of the appellant, Mr. Brown, to present clear indication that there's a property right created under state law. He's not done so in this case.
I've got a liberty interest, though.
With respect to the...
Everybody can go to the park, but this guy, the park's an open space, it's a place people go to relax, enjoy the weather, enjoy looking at the lake. This guy can't do it.
As Mr. Falk indicated, the claim of the liberty interest here is about damage to the reputation of the individual. That's the only claim of liberty interest that he's complaining about.
That's your understanding of Mr. Falk's brief?
Yes, it is. And with respect to that, in order to satisfy the Sigma Plus standard, there has to be a defamatory statement that's made that can be proven to be false. Here, there are no defamatory statements that were made by the park board that could be proven false. The cases he relies upon are cases where people have not been convicted of offenses, but have been accused of them. In this case, there's no question that Mr. Brown was convicted as a child molester. That's true. There's no question he was observed in the park over this period of time, undertaking various activities, which are also true.
None of which don't violate the law.
No. But in order to...
And every other child molester in the city, Michigan City, still gets to go to the park under the present situation.
That's true. But under the Sigma Plus test, it has to be a defamatory statement before we get to the whole issue about whether his legal status has been altered.
Well, isn't the issue that this particular individual statement being made, this individual is dangerous, can't have him in the park?
It doesn't say in the resolution that he's dangerous. What it says is based upon the fact that he is a convicted child molester and has engaged in these activities, we deem that these activities, given he's a convicted child molester, pose a danger to children in the park. That's the conclusion. That can't be proven wrong. How can it be proven wrong that the park board drew this conclusion? It can't be proven wrong.
Conclusion, and distinguish him from the other child molester.
Excuse me?
You distinguish him from the other child molester.
We did.
Separated him out. And so it's not just that he's a child molester.
Correct.
It may have bearing. But the fact that he's doing all of this hanging around and sitting there in the hot weather, and things that we all find rather weird, but he's been doing it for a long time. apparent. Maybe not. Maybe there are other witnesses that will say that. Maybe someone would say he was psychologically just what he needs. We don't know what his mental capacity is. There may be reasons why he doesn't. So I guess that's the distinction that they made. And I look at this as a separate ordinance resolution that starts it anew, as opposed to just, well, said it already the first time, this is a different.
But understanding why it's not a second hearing or resolution required hearing is if you look at what actually happened at that time, they weren't intending to hold a hearing to get new evidence about Mr. Brown because they'd already received all the evidence about Mr. Brown at the initial hearing.
In case in your brief, they didn't.
All the evidence that they knew was available at that time. They're not required to go out and seek evidence they don't have no knowledge of that Mr. Brown has an obligation to present.
Well, I understand that, and I think there's certainly nothing irrational about that. If you see all this activity, you're going to look out for it.
But you did make the determination that he was a danger, right?
We drew the conclusion that he was. And I think it's important because conclusions or opinions about things are not the same as facts that can be proven wrong. And in order for the Sigma Plus test and the Paul versus Davis to apply, it has to be something that can be proven wrong. Even if Mr. Brown had come and presented all the evidence that he claimed he wanted to present, he could not have proven that the conclusion reached by the park board was wrong. So the Sigma Plus test can't be satisfied because they can't meet the first tenet of the Sigma Plus test. Then, with regard to the second tenet, the alteration of the legal status, again, it's incumbent upon Mr. Brown to point to some state law that's been, or state guaranteed rights that Mr. Brown has lost that's protected by the 14th Amendment. He's not done so in this case in the trial court so far. He did not present any particular law or right that he was entitled to exercise that was lost because of the ban that was entered. There is no state statute or no local ordinance that says it protects the rights of people to go into parks. Parks are not like walking into the common public square. There are all kinds of limitations on parks and entry to parks. There are limitations on when they're open. They may be closed for days, months at a time. There's limitations of the time of day that they're open. There's limitations on the activities that could be performed there that would be free to perform in public otherwise. There's limitations on whether people can come to the park depending upon their age and other things as well. So without pointing to a specific guaranteed right, then Mr. Brown can't claim that being banned from the park altered his legal status protected under the 14th Amendment. So he can't satisfy either the first or second component of the Sigma Plus test in this case. So he wasn't entitled to any hearing, notice, and an opportunity to be heard, even though he was given them in this case. With respect to the substantive due process claim, this court has already determined en banc that a child molester's right to enter a park is not a fundamental right. Instead, the government need only show a rational basis for its decision. The obligation of the appellant to prove the decision was irrational or arbitrary. The appellant has not done so in this case. We have undisputed facts of the convicted child molester in the park engaging in what reasonably could be characterized as suspicious behavior. That provides a rational basis to ban him from the park. The question isn't whether all would agree that that's the thing to do. The question is whether or not under these circumstances the government had the right to do that, whether it made a rational decision to do so. There's been no case law presented by the appellant to suggest a decision under these circumstances is irrational. In the Doe versus City of Lafayette case, this court found not only that the decision was rational to ban Doe from the parks in Lafayette in that case, but it was compelling. The government had a compelling interest to do so. That same compelling interest is present here. Mr. Brown was not only convicted child molester, but engaged in a pattern of behavior throughout the course of a month that was observed on a daily basis. In the Doe case, we had only one incident, and I think all the rest of the evidence was that he never even went to the park. And yet the court felt it was compelling on the part of the government to ban him indefinitely from those parks. Here we have an individual by his own admission is coming to the park daily on a multiple basis engaging in what clearly can be characterized as a suspicious behavior. That clearly creates a rational basis for the decision that was made to indefinitely ban him from the park. There's suggestion by the appellant that the decision was irrational because another individual was only banned for a year and a half who engaged in behavior which could violate state law. But the question isn't whether or not one particular person was treated differently than another. The question is, under these circumstances, was the decision a rational one? It doesn't have to be a perfect decision. It doesn't have to be a decision that everyone would agree with.
Would that banning achieve through the same process as a resolution?
I'm not sure if it was actually a resolution, but I presume that it was. I don't think that's in the record, whether it was actually by resolution. We would ask that the decision of the trial court be affirmed and summary judgment be entered in favor of Michigan City on all points. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Key. How much time does the council need to do that? 7 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
May I invite your attention to one issue I would like you to address?
Of course.
On pages 4 through 6 of your reply brief, you seem to be making arguments about liberty interest, which is really not dependent on the stigma plus theory. I have difficulty seeing where that argument was made in your brief in chief, however.
I did not intend to make that argument, Your Honor. I think, in this case, our liberty interest is dependent on stigma plus.
Thank you.
And just to answer a question that was raised concerning the second resolution, at page 39 of the appendix, which is the last page of the minutes of August 29th, the resolution 548 is voted and unanimously rescinded, and if after it is rescinded, then they vote on resolution 552. So a new resolution was adopted on that day. The question was asked whether Mr. Brown had the opportunity to present something, and clearly he did not. Number one, he was told he would be arrested if he came back into the park. He called the park superintendent and said, hey, or he got his daughter's fiance call. And the park superintendent was asked, could you give us something in writing that Mr. Brown will not be arrested because he's been told by the police he would be? The park superintendent said, no, you got to talk to the attorney. They called the attorney, and the attorney said, no. He was only given 24 hours notice. The notice itself was inadequate. There were no reasons. Well, how was he supposed to understand from this why he was being banned? He had engaged in the same behavior for 25 years. And probably most importantly, notice was irrelevant. The resolution, no matter what they said in leading up to it, the resolution on August 1st, resolution 548, banned all sex offenders. It made no difference whether Mr. Brown showed up with 27 psychiatrists saying he was fine and with videos for 25 years showing this on a daily basis, because at that point, Michigan City didn't care. And the Supreme Court tells us in Connecticut Department of Public Safety that if the legislative team doesn't care, there's no due process needed or necessary. What he needed due process for, and what was necessary for, was Resolution 552. That was not merely a cosmetic change. That was changing the focus from banning all sex offenders, regardless, to focusing specifically on the behavior of Mr. Brown and articulating in writing in the resolution that Mr. Brown had engaged in dangerous behaviors in the park. And I don't think at this point that the city can say, well, that's just our opinion that, and it can't be challenged. Now, obviously, that is a statement of fact by Michigan City, and we should have been given the opportunity to contest it. I cited to the court, I believe in our reply brief, some of the cases that occurred that came before Connecticut Department of Public Safety versus Doe, including, I think, the actual Second Circuit case. In those cases, the court held that there was a liberty interest when there was a sex offender registry because there was an implication, just an implication from being on the registry that you are dangerous. Here, Michigan City says it. And it says it forever. It's in the resolution. Mr. Brown has been engaging, has been observed. We have seen him in the park engaging in dangerous behavior.
Now that's the liberty interest issue. I mean the stigma plus whatever.
Well, yes, sir. That is the stigma.
Now, if we don't agree that that's the liberty interest, maybe yes, something else. If you can find it, the stigma plus, yeah. Right?
As far as liberty is concerned, yes.
So now we have property interest left. Now the only way is going to get some sort of a procedural due process here.
Yes, sir.
And does that include is not being able to go in the park and the freedom to go about? And is that can you put that under the umbrella of the property?
Well, there is an understanding that Michigan City has told the world that we have these parks. You're welcome to come in until 10 o'clock when we close it. you have to pay an admission fee. If you're not a Michigan City resident, you are a Michigan City resident, you get in for free. Understanding, Perry versus Tinderman, understanding they're sufficient to support a property claim. That's all that's necessary for procedural due process. But of course, I think there is also a liberty interest. Clearly, this is a stigma. He is being labeled differently than every other sex offender. And that is different than being said you're a sex offender. He said Michigan City is saying, not only you're a sex offender, but you're cruising the parks, you're dangerous, and we have seen you be dangerous. That clearly is a stigma. And as far as the plus factor is concerned, as I said earlier, if he walks into a Michigan City park today, he will be arrested. Clearly, his legal status has been altered. And that is all that is necessary. Wisconsin versus Constantino. Mr. Constantino was not allowed to buy alcohol anymore. Now, I don't know if there was a law in Wisconsin that said everyone can buy alcohol. I'm sure it was a status, just like being able to go into the park is a status. But once that status is removed, that is a plus factor. So we have a stigma plus, and we have the obligation to provide procedural due process, and clearly he was not provided procedural due process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Adina, thanks to both counsel in the case for their excellent arguments today and their excellent briefs as well in this case. The tape will be taken under advisement.